This is KROV Oroville, 91.1 FM, community radio at 2360 Oro Quincy Highway. My name is Lee Edwards, and this program is called Our Town. It deals with local people and local issues. And don't you go away. We got a real special local people today. And remember that contact information for the station, 91.1 FM. We're on the web at www.krov.fm. And a community station is only as good as the number of folks that are willing to participate, so we're looking for participation. Please give us a call at 693-4886, 534-1200, or again, you can access us on the web, www.krov.fm. All right, Pat Koskinen is our guest today, and I got to know her a little bit for other reasons, but very surprised when I called someone from the California Retired Teachers Association and said, I'm looking for some folks to interview, somebody that might come down and talk to the community on our radio station. And so I was referred to Pat. So greetings, Pat. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lee. Thanks for having me.
And I guess to start with, let's start with the association, because that's sort of how I found you. Well, tell me something about the California RTA, I guess they call it.
Right.
California
Retired Teachers Association. It's about 100 years old. It's based in Sacramento. We have close to 50,000 members. And the main purpose of CalRTA is to protect the pensions of teachers, support public education, keep members, retired teachers, informed about what's happening in the world of pensions. And as you know, watching the news all over the nation, an awful lot is happening in the world of pensions.
Yeah, that, I don't know. I'd almost would rather, well, anyway, let's not talk about personalities, but to me, as I see the world around me, and I think how unnecessary it should be to have people watching out for pensions for someone as important as teachers. It almost seems like a comedy. It seems like this is something you'd see on some comedy skit, but it's total reality. And I don't know who I was talking to just the other day about someone who really kind of wanted to retire, but the recent financial mess and everything else made it impossible for this person to retire and put in jeopardy the sanctity of having their own home and living somewhat of an independent life. So this is a real important function. Was it originally designed for that, or is that sort of what you're doing today, the RTA?
No, it was originally designed, approximately now, I think it's about 102 years ago, when a woman noticed a teacher, a retired teacher, an elderly lady, living in a chicken coop outside of Los Angeles. And she started investigating and realized that many of these, and at this point in time historically, most of these retired teachers were women and often widowed or never married and were in pretty dire straits. So she began a movement to have the state of California create pensions for them. They went on to organize. They do so many other things. They provide, of course, camaraderie, social occasions, teachers to get together, but they volunteer all sorts of hours in public education and all aspects of the community that's invaluable to education. They serve on boards of education in their local communities. They provide scholarships, teacher grants to up-and-coming teachers, all of those things.
Well, it's makes me wonder what it would be like without them. Boy, the financial things we hear about can't count on anything. it's really scary out there to me.
Well, I think, you know, I think if one looks back over history and looks at it altruistically, we've gone nowhere but forward. But if you examine it, you see we've taken 10 steps forward, 4 backwards, 3 yeah. forward, 1 foot, 1 backwards, and it's a slow, methodious march to hope and progress, and it is difficult.
What about the local association? I mean, it's California. I know it's a state, but you're sort of like is there like a local chapter? Is there some sort of deal
there
where
is.
Local teachers can get together and have events and things like that?
Absolutely. We are CalRTA Division 32, with membership includes members in Greeley, some in Gridley, but basically Chico, Paradise, and Orville. Chico, Paradise, and Orville have very active chapters with monthly meetings dealing not only with, in quotes, the good they do, but the scholarships, the grants, etc., but the social aspects of it. And anyone interested should look at the website, both for the state organization, which is calrta.org, or locally for our Division 32, division32.calrta.org. That also contact our locally, he's in Chico, our membership director, Dick Corey, at 342-4159. The central office for CalRTA from the state level is right here in Sacramento in a gorgeous new building that's worth a visit as an architectural wonder. But it's 916-923-2200. So those are the numbers and websites, and we'd love to have you join us. It's a very noble fight.
Yeah, it surely is. And again, I keep going back, and I don't know how you were as a little tyke and how you got involved with teaching. To me, that's the substance of this interview. That's the heart and soul of it and the reason for your being here, obviously. But I must say that I sure like the summer times better than I like the school times. And every fall, I get these butterflies in my stomach. But school was not a problem, but it wasn't quite as much freedom and fun as being a selfish kid where you can run around and do things and have fun. So what about Pat Koskinen? What about her encounter with whatever in the world made her want to do a thing like be a teacher, heavens to sakes?
Well, actually, I lived in Westchester County, right outside of New York City. I was 21 years old, graduating from college, had an undergrad degree in history and political science with a minor in English, and intended maybe to go to law school. But I, being a 19-year-old girl, fell madly in love with a young man who wanted to be an architect. We decided to get married, and he still had to go to architectural one more year of architectural school. It's longer than 4 years, so I needed a job. And I managed to get a job teaching, and I could do in a girls' prep school and could do my student teaching under their supervision. So I did so, walked in, and I was 21. They were 17 and 18. So they introduced me to the realities of you're not standing on any title,
yeah,
madam.
Right.
Show us what you know. It was a wonderful experience. Then I stayed married to this young man and moved all over the country. He was an architect for IBM, and we lived in Boulder, Minnesota, down in San Jose. And everywhere we went, I would get a state license and teach.
Oh, my.
I we were living down in Lafayette. We just moved back to California from Westchester, from New York, and I wanted to teach. So I decided. I had encountered alternate high schools, problem kids, on a long-term assignment down in Morgan Hill. So I got my master's in learning difficulties, handicaps, and went to work in Oakland at a residence for problem kids. The official title is severely emotionally disturbed, but that's a catch-all for everything.
Sure.
And then I founded a program for the Akawana School District, a classroom in which they could teach in their own school district these the students. And I fell passionately in love with them and became a resource specialist and did that for the next 15 years.
Wow. That's really neat because just to begin with, of course, you'd have to be there, be that age, but when you think you need some employment, why not? If you're college educated, why not teach after all? But I bet you through the years, there's probably been quite a, series of either innovations or revisions of your approach to the classroom, to teaching. And to me, I'm an outsider, but I see teaching as two things. I see teaching as someone conducting a class and teaching. But I also see it just doesn't happen. You don't walk up there and then start teaching. You know, it involves a lot of preparation, a lot of thought, and probably a lot of learning. Maybe, admit it, teachers might make a mistake or two, and they might say, you know, I don't think I'll do that next term. I don't think I'll present that subject. So here I'm doing the talking instead of you. But what I'm trying to do is wind you up and turn you loose.
Now, you are so very, very rightly. You, to be successful as a teacher, I think, well, my idol in education is, of all people, Maria Montessori, who taught very little children and actually in the slums of Italy to help underprivileged children. But she started a philosophy of education that basically has one bottom rule. Watch the kid. Keep your eye on the student. Don't alter the student. Alter the environment to fit the student and constantly assess and reinforce. And many people may not relate that to a high school classroom with problematic teenagers, but those simple rules are absolutely the basis to me of successful education. And if you do put the focus on the student, you really have much greater success. You hit the nail right on the head. You have to be willing to say, this is not working. I've got to change this lesson. Or, okay, sum it up. They're not doing this today. Maybe another day. You're absolutely right. Techniques come and go. Assessment styles come and, you know, methods of assessment
Sure.
styles come and go. But the one wonderful thing that always stays are the students. And if you watch them, they'll tell you what to do.
And I guess the other thought that I had as I was rambling through my long deal there was the native, what could I say, composition, the basic I don't like to use a word because it sounds like some kind of a non-personal thing, but the makeup of a student, of a child in a classroom, it seems like they have a tremendous engagement. They're so aware. They're waiting for something to come into their mind, whether for entertainment or edification or whatever. So is it generally true that, I guess that's what you just said, you tap into this native curiosity? I assume you...
Exactly.
They have a native curiosity.
All students do. The key is finding out arousing it in older students. Little kids, it's just there.
Yeah.
But society, bad experiences interfere. And sometimes with older students, you have to nurture and bring out that curiosity by observing what they're looking at. What is that person fascinated by? Anecdotally, and I'm desperate with it, I'm terrible with anecdotes about my grandchildren, but when my beloved granddaughter Natalie was 4 years old, we'd wrapped all the Christmas presents that didn't come from Santa, family presents, put them under the tree, and after dinner we saw Natalie sitting under the tree rearranging the boxes. My husband said, "No, Natalie, those are all wrapped. You'll hurt them," as one often does. To, I think
sure.
She was three at the time. You know, you'll mess that up. And I was observing her and just watching her do it. And my son-in-law, who happens to be an attorney but is a gifted negotiator, said, "Well, how about if Natalie does the presents, but Grandma Patty supervises?" And it was wonderful. Everyone went away, and it was Natalie and I observed in 3 minutes she was stacking them first as to size, second as to color, in reverse orders. And one of the basic thinking skills, you know, as they call it, higher level skills, is categorizing and comparing and contrasting. Now, children do these things. But we often interfere. I'm sure you've had the experience of watching a little one turn a doorknob 500 times.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there saying, "Why is he doing that?" I think if you watch him long enough, you'll see that he's figuring out what roundness is.
There you go.
And he's also figuring out back opens, right to close. Right. I'm bad at it. Three-year-old's good at it.
Yeah.
But we often stop them. And we do the same thing with teenagers on a different level. If a student stands up in a classroom or presents in a classroom and says, "I didn't like that story you made me read," many teachers would think the student was being negative and ruining my class, instead of saying, "Why? What was wrong with it?" I mean, you may not have the world's next greatest editor sitting in front of you who really could tell you what was wrong with that story.
That's an insight, the world's next greatest editor. Well, I like that.
That's
a look inside your mind. I like that look.
It's absolutely, I had assigned a class of ninth graders to read Lord of the Flies. And that's a pretty difficult book. And the gist of it is there are two leaders of these children who have been abandoned on an island. One, Ralph, who's very rational, and one who's very physical and the warrior, Jack. And I remember asking a group of students in Oakland, who were a lot of them gang kids, "Okay, who was the better leader, Jack or Ralph?" And this one little character who could badly read looked at me and said, "Mrs. K, that's the stupidest question anybody ever asked." And I said, "Oh, why?" And he said, "Because Jack will get you killed, Ralph will get you killed, and Jack will kill you. You got to be a combination of both."
Whoa.
And I thought, why isn't this boy Secretary of Defense? We waste so much genuine, beautiful talent. It's, because of poverty, parental neglect, overcrowded classrooms.
Sure.
We could talk about all the problems. And there are more problems than anybody could ever imagine. I'm a real crusader on all those issues, as is Cal RTA. But the bottom line is that the students are always there. And they come back next year as wonderful as ever, as open and as talented as ever.
I'm wondering, you must have, you ever truly lost your patience? maybe not externally, but internally with students or classroom situations. You sound like the answer to anybody's prayer who wants to be in school. I just want to know how deep that can possibly run. You must have times when you just, you want to strangle somebody, no?
Of course, absolutely. And I was thinking when you asked that, I think my experience of having the kids be, my first students be, as I explained, 18 to my 21, was unique. They told me when I couldn't lose my temper, or when I was about to. They weren't disrespectful. These were young ladies in a prep school, but they were sharp young women.
Yeah.
And they told me, you know, don't go there. And I think I developed a sense of thinking, teachers should use the Hippocratic Oath. If you can't help, do no harm. So when I was ready to jump up and down on the desk and say, you know, you're all incorrigible and I will not go on, I learned to just, okay, back off.
Yeah.
Do something productive, but take down time.
All right. What about as you were teaching? Now, you mentioned how you came into it. So what I'm interested in is mechanisms, patterns, methods of teaching versus, okay, you're going to do history and these are the books you'll teach. What kind of input did you get to help you pattern what you were going to do teaching? How to teach? I mean, it's not like walking up there and talking. So how did you get that? Was that experiential, or was it something where you had some really good instruction? Or is there a guide to teachers that everybody worships, like people worship the Bible?
I think, to start off with, I had fantastic teachers. And when you begin to teach, you pattern your teaching after what you've experienced. I had some wonderful, wonderful teachers. Second off, the state of New York at that time really required you to have a major in the subject you were going to teach, and eventually within, I think it was 5 years at the time, a master's in it. So you knew your content, your All subject right. content.
Okay.
The methodology, I think, as I said, it comes from the way you were taught. But when you move all over the country and go, I'd have to take classes for another teaching license. I'd have to go to school in Minnesota.
All right, all right.
So each one of them taught me a little something. You know, I mean, a new technique.
Sure.
And when I kept up with it and got to the East Bay, I had to take courses in multiculturalism, different approaches for, so I think being a gypsy taught me how to live in any camp.
Hey, that's a good, I like that. That explains it all in a very brief phrase.
No, but the content first.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it works.
What about changes through the number of years that you were teaching? Methods, I don't know if they exist, the such and such method or the such and such method. Were there things like that that were in vogue, or things that the teachers of teachers were able to teach the teachers? We're noticing this, we're noticing that. How does that work? Are there a group of people that do this, that say, well, this is what teaching's like, and they assess what's going on, and they come up with ideas? Does that happen as you're going through the teaching experience?
Exactly, it does. But a couple of things you have to be careful of. You never get the kid back. So too much experimentation can be dangerous, because if it doesn't work, they're not going to repeat the course. They're not going to learn it. I think I had the good fortune, and this is of teaching in New York, which was when I went to school at the very beginning of my teaching, was a regent's state. We were given a very detailed curriculum, and we weren't told what to teach in the sense of we were given a complete outline of the history of the United States, say, for example, and told, these are the highlights, these are the facts we want students to know. In June, they're going to be given a test on it, so make sure you cover all this material. And it wasn't teaching to the test. We had a content. We had a curriculum, not suggestions, a detailed curriculum. That was a tremendous help to a beginning teacher. And the gimmicks, the different techniques, you tried. But you always had something solid that you kept going back to. And for me, it really was Maria Montessori's simple tools. They will tell you how they're learning.
It interests me, the idea of picturing a Montessori school and real young children. And it interests me to have someone interacting with them as a teacher and then put the same someone at high school level with a bunch of adolescents or whatever, high school age. And it interests me that you would have, I guess, the ability to still be using Montessori methods, but you were, weren't you? In a way.
Yeah, no, definitely.
You were not.
I had, my son was a very active little boy. And when he was two, we moved to Minnesota and his sister went to first grade. So I found Maria Montessori because I wasn't going to survive on the tundra with this little boy. I went to a petting zoo once and matched eyes with a wolf. Not a petting zoo, you don't pet wolves.
Yeah.
But a little children's zoo. And I matched eyes with the wolf, Lady Wolf, and it was 14 degrees out. And I was trudging through the snow with Nick. And she and I commiserated. She knew why I was there. She looked at him, looked at me and said, oh, I know. But that's how I found Montessori School, as playmates and something that was working as a preschool and nursery school environment for a very active little boy. And I served on the board of the school, and I had heard about it, knew about it from history of education courses, but I watched it work. And it wasn't hard for me to adopt many of the same techniques, not techniques, principles more, to adolescents.
Right.
They're really not, they wouldn't like me to say this, but they're really not all that grown up.
Yeah. Well, I would like to say it a different way. I would say something about the preciousness of what exists in them is not destroyed as they age.
No.
So it's just turning you around and saying it the other way.
And
but
in the right direction. You're right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
Oh, my.
They're phenomenal.
By the way, for folks listening, and hopefully we'll be having this on the internet, krov.fm, and you check out our town and you just click a few buttons and hopefully we'll find this, assuming all the gods of electronics are right. But for those tuning in later, for anybody, doesn't matter. This is still Pat Koskinen, no matter when you tuned in. It's still her. And she's, there's an expression you said when I talked to you on the phone prior to this. One, two, three, four words describing yourself. This is like those puzzlers you have. Could you possibly think of those four words that really impressed me when you said what you were and who you were? This is tricky.
I don't remember.
Yeah. A teacher for life. And I says, all right. Now, there's a summary for you. And if after the time you've spent teaching, you can have the enthusiasm and love for it that you do, that you obviously exude, that's a tremendous success story. And I just don't know how many other teachers there are out there. I guess we all have, in quotes, our favorites or ones that we remember. And no matter how much the hard case or how much the academician of the nature, academic nature of the student, surely I think that's if you had to try to make conversation with a stranger, you could start saying, well, do you have any favorite teachers in your life? And maybe they'd only come up with, I had this old battle axe, and describe that one. But that's a really intimate relationship, isn't it? You're given a gift to be there.
Oh, absolutely. A wonderful gift. It's hard work, particularly with difficult students or overcrowded classrooms. It's physically and mentally very challenging work. But I just got lucky falling into a job. You know, I was getting out of school. I told you I needed a job. Doing something I really liked, I would do forever. And whether or not, being in the, around all those energetic, enthusiastic, open-minded young people is the most wonderful experience in the world. They don't have a mortgage.
Yeah.
They don't have a boss.
Yeah.
They are totally and free to examine an idea. They have no vested interest. And they are blessed with an arrogance of, I'm immortal. And
sure.
It's wonderful. They make you feel that way, too. They're like plugging into a battery.
Yeah. Yeah. You see, I would have seen it probably the other way as a person. Yeah. Yeah, I just see the harried feeling that people must have, or the ability of teachers to lose their patience and all those things. And I would think, oh my, but that's not looking into the soul of it, is it? It's not seeing it.
And if you have established a respectful bond with them, they are the most generous, protective people on the face of the earth. I've walked into a classroom and say to a character I didn't think had looked at me for a couple of months, and he'd look up at me and say, Mrs. K, what's the problem?
Oh.
And I'd say, no, I'm fine, no problem. And he'd say, it's your husband. I can tell. Look, if he gives you any problems. And you wonder, these kids are so perceptive. Or
yeah.
You don't feel good, do you? Why don't you sit down? We'll do such and such.
Yeah.
They are the most generous, protective people on earth. Teenagers are not all they are everything they've made out to be, but there's another part to them too.
Yeah, I like the way you said that. That's very nice, Pat. My goodness. Yeah, they're at a stage of life that maybe they'll never recapture it. But then again, when I look at Pat Koskinen, in a way, you've sort of captured it because you understand it. But the average person is going to grow, and their inhibitions and all these other things come along.
I think you have to be open to them and listen to. First off, I think adults have to, authority figures more than anything, have to give them the authority, make them feel safe to speak.
Yeah.
And if they give them a voice, and then if you listen to what they're telling you, I first started teaching, and beautiful young woman, genius, brightest girl, and she wouldn't do her homework or study. And I said, what's the problem? Well, you don't understand. I don't need to go to study all this stuff. I'm going to be a ballerina. So being a teacher, and I looked at her and said, Mary Faith Solinger. I hope she's out there somewhere. You can't think that way. You suppose you broke your ankle. And her response is, if you're going to be a defeatist.
Oh, boy. Boy, she's a step ahead of you all the way.
That's, Lee, that is it. They are a step ahead of us. And if we listen to them, they take us with them.
Yeah.
They do. They know, or God bless them, they believe they can fly to the moon.
Yeah.
And so if you listen to them, they tell you what they're thinking and feeling.
All right. So one of the goals of the teacher is not to step upon the basic soul of your students.
Absolutely.
With restrictions and we must that and this is that. The war of 1812 wasn't fought in 1811. Damn it, it's 1812, and you better remember. So you can't be doing that stuff.
Yeah,
which
no.
isn't important anyway. But that brings a thought in my mind. So long out of school I am, and my kids too, but I hear things like standardize this and standardize that and national scores and blah, blah, blah. And I'm wondering what you could comment on about that part of teaching, that part of the educational system when there seems to be this march toward, I don't know what it is, homogenization or something, like every student in every state should know such and such a fact or something. What's going on?
Well, I think you have to examine it from two, there are two sides to the question. There are states in which education isn't properly funded. There are rural problems. There are difficulties attracting talent. So those students aren't getting a really proper education. Another thing is we're living in a world that is based an awful lot on follow the money. And no one wants to run a school in which 60% of the students are failing because the principal has accountable for that, the school district, et cetera, et cetera. So sometimes standards or expectations are lowered. This leads to a bigger problem. We're a very mobile society. Employer hires somebody based on a resume that says high school diploma. Well, what does that mean? It may be one thing in one state, one part of one state, one school district in one state, and how do we assess our graduates' abilities and needs for further education unless we have more of a universal
All right.
curriculum. So I'm in favor of realizing and having moved my children from one state to another. I can see the need for it.
Okay, then what you're saying is what I was taught in a very timid way, saying, is it really right to be, in quotes, teaching to the test? And what you're saying is you have to have some accountability, some standards by which all teaching is measured. So I should feel more at home because it kind of made me kind of nervous, the idea of this.
I can understand why, because it's a part of the American tradition of local control of schools and things like that. And that's vitally important.
Sure.
I just think we also have to think, and this will sound very stuffy, but as a culture, if you and I meet as adults and we've read the same books, we've heard the same music, we've seen the same plays, maybe we've played some of the same games, eaten some of the same food, we'll have a culture, a base on which to communicate. If education is totally local, where's that bass going to come from?
All right. Yeah. Yeah.
But I think you have, it has to be, there's a difference between dictating and teaching to the test. And I personally, it's arrogant for a newcomer to say, but I think California, I mean, I've been here, I guess, 10 years now. California is the greatest teachers in the world. And always a wonderful school system. Very often I see, though, that up until recently, they had standards and guidelines that were very vague. They're doing a greater job every day in becoming more specific. But having a curriculum, colleges do it all the time.
Yeah.
Is a good thing.
Sure. Yeah.
It is.
Okay. The two questions. So that was one thing hiding in my mind. And the other two things, which maybe you've kind of covered, but again, I'm looking at you as not today. I'm looking at you as I'm seeing this panorama of Pat Koskinen. I'm seeing this whole panorama from this first, I better get a job till I'm a teacher for my life. And I'm wondering, two questions, basically. Changes you've observed in teaching methods, methodology, which I've kind of hinted at before. And the other question is changes in subjects offered, both in terms of what you've observed or what you'd like. In other words, what subjects aren't being offered that you'd like, or are there techniques that are fortunately teachers are having access to that you didn't have when you started? And that's sort of a broad question, but I'm sure you got some thoughts on it.
You said curriculum things. I feel that history and social studies are being slighted. Citizenship. We don't teach civics, history, as much as we used to. I think we are putting too much emphasis on a college prep, one-size-fits-all curriculum, and not realizing there are many different aspects. You know, you can teach math with AutoCAD and at the same time, or with sound equipment. I think we have to be more imaginative to reach more students than the strictly college prep academics. So that I think has been to an extent a loss. I think one loss we've had, and here is a plug for teachers, up until 1973, with the passage of the Equal Employment Opportunity Act and Title IX, women became teachers. 50% of the population who were academically inclined and talented either became nurses or teachers. You know, God bless them, we did have the Ruth Bader Ginsburgs, the pioneers. But most women saw teaching or nursing as something with flexibility. They could deal with raising a family. With the passage of those laws, by the 1980s, young women were going into graduate schools in all areas, science, math, technology, computer science, and they were being offered many more employment opportunities, and they didn't go into education.
Right.
So you lost a tremendous part of your teaching talent pool, and you've never replaced it. And I think, like anything else, you have to make the job attractive for the most talented people to take it. And that's a problem. So that's something I'd love to see in education, attracting more and more talented people to education. I think something like Teach for America, when we get young, talented people into a classroom, is absolutely fantastic. We need it. I worked with teachers, young teachers, Teach for America, people in Oakland, and they were fantastic.
Well, what's the program about? Could you describe it?
Just that they agree to teach in where they're needed, perhaps in an urban or rural environment, for a certain, you're pretty much anywhere, though they're needed. And college loans are forgiven, and they're given a small salary. You know, the details keep changing, but that's,
sure,
that's the basic idea. And if you get a teacher who's been doing it with, for 20 years, and you bring in a 22, 23-year-old person who is totally up, current academically, and has the vitality and enthusiasm, they're the greatest combination in the world. I loved it.
Yeah.
And so that's something I would think. I think the biggest challenge facing education, and there are too many, shouldn't say that, a big challenge facing education today is technology. I've been reading about the flipped classroom. They began having great success with it outside of Detroit in school districts that were absolutely failing. And the deal is kids go home and watch a video of the lecture or the presentation, and then the next day in the classroom do the learning with the teacher walking around interacting with them. And it's been tremendously successful. I'd like to see that happen. Using that technology. The kids who don't have computers watch it in a lab at school or after school or at a library. And it's available to anyone. Their actual classroom teacher makes the video, so it's they're familiar, and then with everything they can listen to it two or three times. They've also discovered that keeping the caption on, kids learn twice as much because they're
sure
seeing and hearing,
right?
You know, two sensory experiences, two modalities. It's wonderful, but it's new and it's expensive.
Yeah.
I often, coming here, I thought, well, how does a student in Altura have access to a fantastic physics teacher? Well, can't always get one. So I remember speaking to the superintendent, and he said his goal was to be able to do online classes, like you've all heard and read, so that a student would be in the math class or the science class or any area, maybe German, maybe learning Chinese. The master class would be presented in a classroom all over at the same time, and credentialed teacher would be in the room to supervise, help the students, all those things. And one of the things that, two things hurt us in getting these things done. Number one, money. The equipment costs money, but also teachers who have been doing it one way for 25 years don't want to learn a new way to do it.
Yeah.
But I heard my granddaughter and grandson, their twins, had an interactive whiteboard in their first grade classroom. And all I could think of is if a child says the word elephant, and I was the teacher, I could jump up to my whiteboard and go, elephant, why don't we all and we'll have the march of the elephants.
Yeah.
The music. And the constant information that kids have access to. The great art of the world. It would be, you know, I mean, it would be fun.
It'd be stretching the mind, that's for sure.
And engaging.
Yes, yes. Pat Koskinen today, by the way, here on KROV Oroville. Let's see, there was another thing I had. Oh, a silly thing. I'm still going back to being a kid, and I love to go fishing, and I couldn't do it while I was in school. And I think of the teacher, and when school was out for me, I assumed school was out for the teacher, and then they started next September, you know, we stopped in June. What about the average teacher's year, if there is such a thing as an average? What's it like? How does it work? Because let's say school is out whenever it is now, but it used to be in the first part of June, and you don't have to teach till September. Is that really free time? Is that time for vacation? Or what goes on with most teachers in that during this time?
Most teachers worked 3 to 4 hours a day outside of a classroom. They're there early. Mm-hmm. They're there late. At least a half hour.
Yeah.
They prepare lessons. I was a special ed teacher, so I did IEPs, individual education plans. I planned lessons. I did research. I did reports. I did all sorts of things at home. I reviewed materials, books, and videos, whatever I might use in the next year. That's one thing I would like to really give a plea for sympathy for teachers. I have friends. I work with the American Association of University Women for Tech Trek. That's a week-long summer camp that we send only in the, well, it's a California program, but we send girls at the end of seventh grade to 6 universities. In the Davis is the one our Orville girls go to. Used to go to Stanford, and they opened a second one because so many girls were going. But and when I work with my friends who aren't teachers, they say, "Well, I called, and she didn't call me back." And I want to think, do you realize where this woman is?
Yeah.
She or this gentleman is? They're not sitting at a desk.
Right.
Teachers, those hours where, in quotes, the kids are there, you're on.
I understand that.
You cannot make a phone call.
Right.
So that's another job. Calling parents, making contacts, making arrangements for a field trip. All of that is outside of class time. It really is.
Yeah.
Because particularly the size of today's classes, the students. When I started teaching, I could say, okay, open your history text to page such and such and do the first 4 essays. I couldn't do that at the end of my career. Kids' attention spans were shorter.
Yeah.
They didn't write as much.
Yeah.
So it's teachers work a tremendous amount.
Yeah, but my main point wasn't how tough it is to be there, because again, just it's not just being there in front of the classroom. Obviously, tremendous preparation. But what about when the school year is out? Are teachers doing something in the interim specifically for their school year? Or are they really allowed to just take some time off and just breathe?
Well, there are two factors. They have to be doing something for their school year. Things being as hectic as they are today.
Yeah, you're freed from the burden of day-to-day teaching, and now you can do some things you probably couldn't get to otherwise.
Right, but I'll tell you a horror story, that teachers are also working.
Yeah.
If you're trying to support a family on a reasonably beginner's teacher salary, you're working in the summer. Many, many teachers have summer jobs, running camps, working in all sorts of, working, period.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah.
And one of CalRTA's causes is they don't get their Social Security. It's cut considerably because California teachers have a state pension system.
Oh, yes.
That they contribute to. But many teachers do both or have taught in another state.
Yeah.
And 80% of our CalRTA members are entitled to Social Security and don't get it. Don't get the total. So we're working very hard to get that fixed. But they work. Coaches.
Yeah.
They coach.
Sure.
Work summer school. Summer school is big now.
Yeah.
Most school districts are running lots of classes.
Okay, so it engages the mind and it engages the body time-wise. It's like taking on a life, sounds like. I mean, you really are taking on a life when you're a teacher. You're not punching a clock. You're always engaged.
Yeah. And there's so many meetings, after school meetings, parent meetings with parents, and there are educational requirements. Yeah. Teachers have to keep earning units. So you're also spending a lot of time going to school. And teachers will suddenly be, the state will say, well, we should have a credential for teaching cross-cultural students.
Right.
And teachers have to go get that. A lot of education involved.
Okay, once again, Pat Koskinen here with me, a teacher for life. Anything you'd do differently? I'm talking about teaching maybe more than your personal life, obviously. Sounds like you've experienced it. You've adapted to change. You've kept your mind sharp, concentrated, and you've been able to find joy. Is anything missing?
Well, like I think anyone with any profession, I think I'd be more aware that the day would come when I wouldn't see Mary Faith Solinger in her ballet shoes anymore.
Right.
It would be even more precious to me.
Sure.
But I think one would say that about anything in life.
Sure.
It would be even more precious. Because I would realize that it's not going to be, I'm not going to be doing this forever or with these people. Forever.
Sure. This is going to pass, and you better appreciate it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I did appreciate it in that I enjoyed every minute of it, but I think I could have done even more. And I think I might have even tried harder in certain instances. I don't know physically, but I would have tried harder.
Yeah.
Because it was so very precious.
Yeah.
The time was.
To me, I see.
You know, it's like having a child.
Yeah.
When they go away from home, they're gone.
Yeah.
And you always think, you know, would I do it again differently?
Yeah, don't tell me. I know that one very well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any contact with prior students? Do they ever keep in touch in any way, or are they just gone forever?
No, always. Some of it written, write, email. Some of it just casually. I just had a reunion on Skype, a Skype reunion, with my first class.
Oh my, how precious.
And that was just a delight.
Oh.
And what amused me, and what was wonderful is, I got on, and these were the girls, and my class of girls, they all looked at me and they said, oh look, she's cut her hair. They thought I was exactly the same.
They expected you to be
they
that.
They expected to turn on the screen and see Mrs. Koskinen.
Yeah, well, they should look in a mirror. They aren't the same either.
No, they meant it. It was really said very nicely.
I know.
It's just you encounter them because I've moved, not as much, but students in Oakland, you know, I've been on the BART and with my son and came across as really cool because this character, how should we put it? A gentleman who one might worry what their purpose in running towards you was.
Yeah.
Started running towards me and shouting Shorty. And it was one of my old students.
Oh.
And it was, and he ran up to me and hugged me. And it really was a delight.
Good.
I also noticed the thing that makes me feel good is they contact me. I mean, I get contacts when One of them has died, which God is beginning to happen. They were only 3 years younger. Nice. But when they get divorced, they contact me when something bad happens. And that makes me feel very good. You know, because it's, or when something big happens.
Sure.
So it's sort of a family connection.
Wonderful. Well.
But you do, and you do have contact with them.
Okay. Well, that kind of covers most of my thoughts in many ways, and I really appreciate you coming in today. What is it that Pat Koskinen wants to say that I didn't give her a chance to? Is there anything like that lurking out there in the recesses of your mind?
Just quickly, teachers need your help. They need your support. They need somebody to say, I think you're doing a good job. I wrote a letter to the editor in which I mentioned that one of the saddest things, or hardest things, I shouldn't call it. Teachers don't know what happens. You're throwing seeds out into the
right.
wind. And you go every day and work hard, and you don't always hear the student 20 years later say, you know, she really did this, that, or the other thing, or he really did this, or the other thing for me. So they need our support. Also, I feel, and one of the reasons for CalRTA, is that the political and economic climate is attacking them. I know we have money problems, but I think sometimes when that happens, people become, they're looking for a scapegoat. Well, they don't need those pensions.
Yeah.
Or they only work 3/4 of a year.
Yeah.
And all of these things. I think they need our support, and I think quickly, we should remember what we value. We give these people, our children, the minds that are going to operate on our brains or run our governments.
Right. Very good.
And we don't act like what they're doing is very important. So I question that. I really do. It's so hug a teacher. Tell them thank you.
There you go.
You tried.
Yes, and if you can't see them in person, hug them mentally. They'll probably get the spirit
right.
coming through.
And when you get into the voting box, what do you want to spend your money on?
Yeah.
What's really important to you? And if it's not our kids, if it's not the future, even from a selfish point of view, of what kind of a world, you know,
yeah.
will we be living in our old age?
Okay.
Let's face it, we're in their hands. Mm-hmm. Scary as that sounds.
Times have changed, Pat, since you started teaching. All right. Well, thanks a million again, Pat Koskinen, for stopping
by. Thank you
by.
For having me.
Sure, my pleasure.